It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Two Republican bills circulating in the state legislature seek to change regulations for different aspects of the THC industry. THC is one of the chemicals derived from cannabis plants.
Marijuana is not legal in Wisconsin, but businesses can turn hemp into THC products in the form of drinks and edibles, for example, that are being sold around the state.
One bill would change the legal definition of hemp to ban most psychoactive hemp-derived THC products. The other bill would legalize medical marijuana in non-smokable formats.
Both bills would shake up the THC industry in the state that exists because of a loophole in the 2018 Farm Bill that legalized the sale of hemp-derived products like Delta-8 THC.
We're checking in on the hemp business in Wisconsin as more dispensaries pop up across the state. And Jeremy Smith is here, president and CEO of Tab Ease. It's a Waukesha-based company that produces and sells hemp-derived THC products. Jeremy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Happy Monday, and thanks for having me on the line.
How big of a market is there for hemp-derived THC products in Wisconsin? Kind of set us up here with what you see.
I mean, there's no question about demand. It's huge. Wisconsin consumers want safe, tested, and regulated cannabis options. And right now, hemp-derived THC is filling that gap exactly. The demand exists because neighboring states have legalized marijuana, and people here don't want to drive across the border or deal with unregulated street products. The hemp-derived market has grown precisely because it's legal, accessible, and accountable. Products are safe, taxes are paid, and consumers know what they're getting. The hemp industry has become Wisconsin's informal cannabis system, and it's employing hundreds and generating millions of tax revenue and keeping sales local instead of sending them to Illinois and Michigan.
Informal cannabis system. Can you talk about the variety of products that you see, the range of products that you're seeing, and the changes?
When you go to a hemp dispensary, you're going to find the Wisconsin legal equivalent to what you might find in a Illinois or Michigan dispensary. And it fills every single void. And the hemp industry in Wisconsin is growing, and people are becoming aware of the great products that are here to offer.
Can you talk more to that? What is driving the demand? Why do you think the THC products industry has taken off here?
Well, Wisconsin is an island at the moment. Illinois and Michigan both have legal cannabis programs, and you have a bunch of hungry entrepreneurs in the state who are essentially planning and building their infrastructure to be prepared for once Wisconsin does legalize or have some type of program for businesses and consumers.
Meanwhile, this bill that is circulating, what do you think a ban on these THC products would do to your business and others like it in the state?
A ban would wipe out legitimate and small businesses overnight. You know, people who follow the law, paid taxes, and built something sustainable would be the ones affected. It wouldn't make THC go away by any means. It would just push the business underground or across state lines. And that means lost jobs, lost tax revenue, and less consumer safety. For me personally, I've built an entire supply chain, manufacturing, retail, wholesale, all compliant under current law. And a ban would destroy that infrastructure overnight. You know, it's like shutting down craft breweries because we think beer is causing a problem. People wouldn't stop drinking. They'd just stop buying Wisconsin-made beer.
Jeremy, in terms of compliance in regulating hemp-derived THC products by state government, have you seen uniform enforcement from the state?
The enforcement's a little bit tricky. The laws aren't exactly all clear, and From my aspect, we want regulation. We want smart regulation, you know, required testing, labeling, child-resistant packaging, and age-restricted sales. You know, require transparent sourcing and verifiable tax trails. These are good for everyone, but we don't want to punish compliance by outlawing it. The goal should be to make products safer and traceable, not to eliminate an entire industry that's already playing by the rules. And we've proven that responsible cannabis commerce can exist in Wisconsin. We just need a framework that protects consumers without killing the innovation.
Jeremy Smith is with us, president and CEO of the Waukesha-based TabEase, as we talk about THC regulation in Wisconsin. Jeremy, the authors of the bill to regulate these hemp products point to health concerns, especially for children who might consume them. What would you say to those who are worried about how people are affected when they use THC products?
I mean, if the main concern here is to protect our children, you know, right now we have an age gate at retail stores where IDs are checked. And if we get rid of that, the demand for these products aren't going to go away. And the methods of how people obtain those products and get them to minors will change. You know, we have the age gate right now at retail, and this is just going to push the demand and the sales to out of state or to the underground market. And, you know, in that case, if when business does go to the underground market, the stores that are selling hemp derived THC products right now aren't selling all of the other narcotics and drugs that the underground sells. So in my opinion, that would effectively turn hemp derived or hemp into a gateway drug that, you know, that by just the dealers offering everything else.
Well, let's turn to this other bill that is circulating where, you know, it says patients could ingest medical marijuana through edibles or vapors, but would not be allowed to smoke it. If medical marijuana were to be legalized in our state, how do you think it would affect the hemp-derived THC business?
I mean, you know, everyone I talk to and all my business partners, we're all in the hemp derived THC business. You know, we look at it as one. We don't look at it as we're hemp and you're marijuana. We're all in this for the plant. And so, and that is exactly why we're all reinvesting our money and investing into Wisconsin infrastructure so that we can participate or be able to participate in any type of medical or recreational bills that Wisconsin does plan to go with. So, I mean, I think that, you know, if we did get some type of program, you know, our hemp derived businesses are going to be looking at they're going to look at the medical marijuana or rec or whatever we do as guidelines and light at the end of the tunnel so that we can, you know, so we can actually invest in something that's that has some weight to it.
Would there still be a market for hemp-derived alternatives if, you know, a day came where recreational marijuana was legalized?
I think that the demand would plummet, and that's okay because currently THC products are the products that are holding the entire hemp industry up. I don't think that Wisconsin could have the infrastructure in hemp that it has with only offering CBD as the cannabinoid. Hemp is the cannabinoid industry. Mm-hmm. There's many cannabinoids in the plant, CBD, CBG, CBN, THC, you name it. We're only looking at the tip of the iceberg at the moment. And so I think there will still be some demand for hemp, but how we you know, go about that and one idea that I have is that, you know, we already have a start to a cannabis program, which is hemp. Why don't we start looking at regulating hemp instead of creating an entire new program? Because, you know, we've seen pros and cons to every single state legalization program that has happened. And starting with hemp seems to be a really logical way of looking at this.
Jeremy, have you been talking with state lawmakers about your concerns about the industry? And if so, what have those conversations been like?
I have been talking to state legislatures, and you know, there's a mix. This is a controversial topic, and you know, it's hard to say where it's going to go or what's going to happen, but I think that, I mean, we just need to consider hemp businesses and the infrastructure that our citizens have invested in as we develop our marijuana programs, because, you know, it's inevitable. The writing is on the wall that there's demand. It's not going away, and there's no way of restricting it from being in our state. So I think we need to start looking at how do we regulate? How do we make it safe with the existing infrastructure that we do have? Because we're so far away from any other program, it seems.
Would you support an Office of Medical Cannabis that would, you know, be created to oversee licensing for cannabis growers and processors and testers?
Yeah, I would. But again, I do think that any type of bill that we propose needs to have the hemp businesses and the hemp infrastructure in the state in mind when we go to do that.
Jeremy, thank you for your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jeremy Smith is president and CEO of Tab Ease. It's a Waukesha-based company that produces and sells hemp-derived THC products. He was with us to share how proposed hemp regulations and other marijuana policies could affect his industry in Wisconsin.
Coming up, a new study digs into air quality near large livestock farms. We'll get the results and meet a Pierce County resident who wants local government action on CAFOs.
There's just not enough oversight. So the biggest concern that we have and what we're trying to do is create some ordinances at the town level that will create some oversight.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. For some people, the smell of cow manure is the smell of Wisconsin. There are more than 1.2 million cows in the state, and those animals produce a lot of manure.
Industrialized farming practices have led to what's known as concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. The State Department of Natural Resources defines these as farms with 1,000 or more animals. And the size of those farms and the amount of waste has led to environmental concerns and pushback in many communities.
Researchers at the University of Michigan recently crunched the numbers and found that there are 15,000 large-scale animal feeding operations nationwide, and that a quarter of them are located in just 30 counties. Benjamin Goldstein is assistant professor of environment and sustainability at the University of Michigan. He's a co-author of that study. Benjamin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
This study, you're looking at where these large animal farms, these CAFOs, are located around the country. Now, it seems like this should be easy. Okay, we're going to find out where the CAFOs are and what counties they're in and how big they are. As I read your report on that, it was a little more complicated even to figure out those basics. Why is that?
It's a good question. There is no authoritative and exhaustive list of CAFOs and their locations across the United States. Often, this is at the discretion of the states on what type of information to collect about animal feeding operations within their jurisdiction. And so really what we have to work with are a few different data sets that we could quilt together. One of them is from the EPA, because they do like to track this type of thing. And so they get the information that the states are provided. And then there's also a couple of business data sets that have tried to provide additional information about where CAFOs are. And so we took these three data sets and we looked at where they said animal feeding operations were. And some of the times they would be reporting the same operation, so we would remove those duplicates. Other times they were pointing towards a location where we didn't see any evidence of an animal feeding operation, and we would remove that. And then after, you know, that left us with about 10,000 different animal feeding operations, we went through systematically at a 6-mile by 6-mile grid across areas where we had the sense that there was underreporting of animal feeding operations. Like, we could see them from the satellite imagery, but they weren't in any of the data sets that we'd already looked at. And then we added those to this more comprehensive data set. And at the same time, we mapped out the actual size of each animal feeding operation, which is also a new addition here, because that is different than what we had before, which was just points. It was just a location. But now we actually know the size of the different animal feeding operations, which is important because it allows you to ask different questions, really. Because if you know the size, then you can see if bigger sizes relate to different types of impacts on the local communities.
Now, I'm looking at your map right now. No surprise, Wisconsin and your state of Michigan have a lot of counties with serious acreage devoted to these larger farms. Not the most dense. There are bigger ones in the country. Let's get into some of those questions now people in Wisconsin and Michigan might be asking. One thing you looked at, pollution, and a lot of times I think, of course, water pollution, you're also looking at air pollution. What did you find when you correlated, hey, here's where these CAFOs are and here's the air quality?
One thing that we know about CAFOs just anecdotally, and AFOs, and I should really clarify, this is about animal feeding operations, which is slightly different than a confined animal feeding operation. So animal feeding operations is a broader umbrella term that captures the CAFOs, but also non-CAFOs. So bigger farms where the animals have more space to be spread out. But that said, we know that large animal feeding operations, often there is a lot of hooves actually just disturbing the vegetation and often trampling it down. And so you end up with a lot of bare ground, dirt, and dust that eventually gets kicked up into the air. And this air then has small particulate matter that lingers in the air for hours at a time and travels significant distances. And it can actually penetrate deep into our lungs when we breathe it in. And if we do enough of this, it can actually generate scar tissue within our lungs. And so this can turn into long-lasting health impacts for those who breathe it in. And we found that all things being equal, so when we compared areas that had lots of CAFOs and large CAFOs to areas that had an absence of CAFOs, but were in the same climate, had the same industrial makeup, had similar geographical characteristics, that the ones that did have the AFOs in them had a higher concentration of this particulate matter in the ambient air. And so that means that with high likelihood that AFOs are contributing to higher levels of particulate matter in the air in those proximate communities.
And this is that PM2.5 particle. We got really interested in this when wildfire smoke was coming into Wisconsin over this last summer. This can be a serious problem. What would that point you toward to follow up research when it comes to, okay, we see these pollutants in these areas. How can we measure if there's an impact on human health?
Right. And that's really tricky. It's really tricky because we have all these confounding variables. We have wildfires, we have roads, we have other industrial sites that are creating pollution, right? And so we can't say 100% with certainty that it is these AFOs that are the sole reason that we have these higher particulate matter concentrations in the ambient air. But there are more sophisticated types of analyses that other people can do, hopefully taking our data set and really controlling for all those variables. So that would mean, for instance, looking at time of year and making sure that you weren't sampling the air when there were wildfires, for instance, and wildfire smoke, and then canceling that out so that we can properly attribute this particulate matter with 100% certainty. We have very high certainty right now, but still we can't really say 100% certainty. But deal with those uncertainties and really show that it is actually the AFOs that are, you know, driving higher particulate matter in those areas.
You also asked a different kind of question about who is living in these counties that have a lot of these larger animal feeding operations. You looked at some demographic things and healthcare coverage. What kind of things did you learn?
Well, it's sort of a mixed picture across the country. We found, you know, I guess in a positive note, in a place like Wisconsin, even though there are significant numbers of CAFOs, and that we have made this link between, you know, the AFOs and the particulate matter in the paper, that there's also high levels of insurance coverage for people that are in Wisconsin that are living near those AFOs. Not the same for other types of, or other locations of the country. For instance, you can see in our findings, we found that New Mexico, Texas, Kansas, there are actually high concentrations of these animal feeding operations alongside high concentrations of people that do not have health insurance. And so this is very problematic. If you're getting sick from being nearby industrial facilities but don't have insurance to cover you. But I would also argue that it's better to not get sick in the first place, even if you do have insurance.
And finally, Ben, I get the impression you've hinted at this, I think, that you've done this mapping, you've done this work finding out where these animal feeding operations are. You've picked a couple questions to ask using the maps you've made now, but you're hoping that people are going to take some of this baseline work you've done and run with it. What are your hopes for future research, whether you are personally involved in it or not?
One is that we can move away from correlation, so seeing the link, just say, because right now we have correlation. We can see that there's CAFOs and AFOs in a location and we see higher particulate matter. But we want to move to causality to show that indeed it is the animal feeding operations that are causing that particulate matter. Not looking to blame them, but at least to make that link if it is there. And or at least to disprove that link if it isn't. So to really clarify that would be my number one research question. And then the second one would be about what you said with water pollution, because this allows us to ask all types of questions now, not just related to air pollution, but also the impacts of large animal feeding operations on local water quality. So this data set hopefully provides the ammunition for other researchers to do that.
Ben, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your research with us.
I'm just happy you took an interest in it, and have a great day.
Benjamin Goldstein is Assistant Professor of Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. Now for some perspective on what it's like to live and work near a large animal farm, we turn to Larry Brenner, who lives in Pierce County on the border with Minnesota, where he runs the outdoor dining venue Vino in the Valley. Larry, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, as we mentioned, you're in Pierce County. You're near this large animal feeding operation, Ridgebreeze Dairy, with 1,700 cows now. An expansion plan next year to 6,500 cows. Can you talk a little bit about what it is like near this farm with the current numbers?
Well, with the current numbers, I know two things when I have an east wind. One, as the old farmers will tell us, it's going to rain. And two, when I wake up in the morning and head outside, the smell is not very good. Now, thankfully, we don't have a lot of east winds that are more predominant depending on the season, out of the south or out of the north. But you can really, really tell when I walk outside in the morning what direction the wind is out of. So there are two CAFOs actually right next to each other, but Ridgebreeze is the one that's going from 1,700 to 6,500. And that's where we're, you know, really concerned as neighbors.
And you and some of your neighbors sign a petition saying, hey, let's have another look at approving this expansion. What are some of the concerns you're raising?
Well, there's very little oversight. The DNR has a few, you know, the feds don't have any oversight. The state, it just has the DNR, and they're very, very understaffed. In fact, our guy, Jeff Jackson with the DNR, he's got 26 CAFOs that range in geography from Superior, Wisconsin, down to Trempealeau County by Arcadia, Wisconsin. So he's got a big territory. And the other big concern is that, there's only 1.5, that's one full-time and one part-time person that's actually looking over the nutrient studies. And those are very, very, very detailed. And there's just not enough
enough oversight. So the biggest concern that we have and what we're trying to do is create some ordinances at the town level that will create some oversight. Do they have a plan for fire? Do they have a plan for diseases? Like mad cow used to be a big deal, and then the avian flu, and now there's another new strain down in Texas that who knows where that's going to end up. But there's just very few plans for, you know, accidents that certainly could happen when you're talking about 80 million gallons of manure being produced a year.
You, in addition to living there, have an outdoor restaurant, Vino, in the Valley. Does the dairy farm affect your business, do you think? And do you think an expansion would be a concern for that?
You know, Rob, to this point, it hasn't been a major concern, again, because the predominant winds are out of the north and the south in the winter when we're open. We're a seasonal restaurant, and it is outdoor. So my concern is twofold with the business, really. We're only about, you know, just a little over a mile, I tell people, 7,000 feet from their furthest west lagoon that they're building, which is going to hold 44.5 million gallons of liquid manure. And, you know, that festering or in the sunlight, brewing in the sunlight, I don't know what that's going to create. You know, time will tell. And the other big thing is the storm runoff and just the runoff from the fields. I have two wells here. I have my home well and my business well, and they're very much in danger. We're downhill. We're in the valley right below Ridge Breeze, and we all know which way, you know, manure flows. So we're very, very concerned about our water quality, and, you know, water is everything for us. And if we lose that, that's going to have a big effect on our business, because we use water in our cooking, it's in our ice for our drinks, and you know, we serve about, give or take, 2,000 people every 4-day weekend from May until the end of October. And we're very scared. It's a family-run business, and I don't know what to expect. So we're just hoping that we can get the town, the townships in the area on board with some ordinances so that we have some things to fall back on if and when an accident occurs.
What do nitrate concerns in those wells mean for how you handle water in the restaurant? Are you filtering? Are you taking measures for that there?
It's a great question. I'm already living the dream, or the nightmare, I guess you'd call it. I have a second restaurant down in Buffalo County, up on the ridge between Fountain City, Wisconsin, and Arcadia, Wisconsin. And there are many, many, many large chicken CAFOs up there, big operations. They've been there forever, from Arcadia Friars days to, they were sold to Golden Plump, and then they recently sold to Pilgrim, which is an international poultry company. And my restaurant down there was teetering right around that 10 parts per million, and then it went up over the top to 13, and the health department basically made us put up signs that if you are a female, you're pregnant, you're planning on being pregnant, you're nursing, or you have young children, you can't drink our water. And that doesn't do a whole lot for business either. I did put in a Kinetico filtering system, about 9 months ago, and it has worked so far, but we have to be measured every quarter, and we're in kind of like a probation period with the health department. They have to measure us every quarter, and after we have four successful quarters of being below 10 parts per million, then we can take those signs down. But for the entire future of that restaurant, I have to go through quarterly measurements because they, you know, they know that if the filtering system shuts down, we immediately could go over the top. So those signs don't do us any favors. They're wherever, you know, water is distributed in the restaurant, and a young lady comes back from the bathroom and she's asked our waitresses in the past, or the women have, what's the deal with the water here? And we have to explain, and it doesn't usually end well. So I'm already living it down in Arcadia, and I'm terrified it's going to happen here. And this particular place has been open for 19 years, and
you know, we get a ton of people, a lot of tourism from the Twin Cities, and that's about 75% of our business. So these people will be very concerned if our water is not drinkable.
Now, you mentioned you're hoping for the local government to do some kind of oversight. Are there things, you're operating in a couple different places in the state now, are there things you'd like to see change at the state level when it comes to permitting or oversight of these larger animal operations?
Well, they're going to have to wake up pretty soon, I think, and realize that this is not just a local problem in a couple of places in the state of Wisconsin. It's statewide. There's right now 342 and counting CAFOs in the state of Wisconsin, and you know that's affecting a lot of people. So, yes, I'd like to see a study and more. I know Minnesota is already starting a five-year study, and I've seen bits and pieces that Wisconsin is thinking about it as well. But, you know, once these things are built and they're producing all of this manure and all these nitrates, that horse has left the barn. So I wish they would get going, and this thing's ramping up quickly, and they've got to, you know, they got to move forward and start coming up with some guidelines and some, these places have to have plans for all of the different things that could happen.
Larry, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Larry Brenner is owner of the restaurant Vino in the Valley in Pierce County. That's located next to a large dairy operation with plans to expand. Earlier, we heard from Benjamin Goldstein, assistant professor of environment and sustainability at the University of Michigan. He's one of the authors of a study that looks at the geography of CAFOs and other large animal facilities around the U.S. and their connection to elevated air pollution.
Coming up, a new cookbook collects recipes from a unique source, gravestones around the country. Find out what favorite foods Midwesterners want people to remember them by.
Some of the recipes are like pretty short and sweet, or they're like a classic grandmotherly recipe that makes a million cookies.
It's the author of To Die For, a cookbook of gravestone recipes. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A gravestone recipe is etched into a person's final resting place, and each recipe is a glimpse into somebody's life, preserved in granite. You can find these kind of markers in cemeteries all over the country.
Like a recipe for spaghetti chicken casserole at a gravesite in Racine, easy potato rolls from Pine River, Minnesota, and red lantern cheese dip in Dow City, Iowa.
The author of a new cookbook describes herself as a taphophile. She's passionate about cemeteries and gravestones. While researching funerary practices, she learned about the creative ways people mark their graves.
Rosie Grant is the creator behind Ghostly Archive on TikTok and Instagram. Her new book is called To Die For, a cookbook of gravestone recipes, and it features 40 gravestone recipes with stories about the people who made these dishes. Rosie, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
When we picture a headstone, you know, we think of a person's name and the dates of their birth and death, and maybe there's an epitaph, but you say there are so much more elaborate and creative approaches to gravestone markers. What kinds of things have you seen?
Oh my gosh, literally anything that you could imagine that might be important to a person, I've probably seen onto a gravestone. That might be people's pets, hobbies, someone's fishing pole that they liked using, their boat that they loved driving, their local nickname, anything, favorite movie quotes, and then, yes, of course, a favorite recipe. It's just so fun to see a modern cemetery has so many different markers for memorials these days.
You write about how you first encountered gravestone recipes, that you hadn't seen them before. Can you talk about that first time?
Yeah. So the first one I learned about was for a woman named Naomi Odessa Miller Dawson, who's buried in Brooklyn, New York. And at the time, I was interning at Congressional Cemetery in Washington, D.C., and I'd started a TikTok account about what it's like to intern at a cemetery just because this was a new world for me. And I thought, you know, the death industry was endlessly interesting. So while I was doing that, I was featuring different unusual memorials because I was so used to the, like, traditional epitaph of, like, mother, father, a spiritual quote, a memento mori symbol, like, you know, the wing and skulls. And I was so struck seeing Naomi's gravestone. I saw it on a blog called Atlas Obscura, and it has this really beautiful, it looks like an open cookbook. And it's this book on a pedestal and her recipes inscribed on it. And I was so struck by that. So I tried making her cookie recipe, and that kind of led the journey to other gravestone recipes.
I like also how you brought it to her grave and ate those cookies there. As you reflected on the recipe.
Yeah, that felt like, I mean, it started a little organically. With Naomi, I was driving through New York, and my mom and I were going to stop by to visit her, and I was thinking of what flowers would she have liked and wanted to, you know, have left on her grave. And then I figured, well, you know, she made these cookies. Maybe I should make her cookies, and then, you know, we can have like a little moment thinking about her at her gravestone. And when it came to with Naomi, I was like, well, if I'm visiting Naomi, I should visit this other woman who's buried nearby. So we went and did the same thing with Connie. And then, you know, a third person, when I visited this woman named Kay, who's buried in Utah, she has a fudge recipe. And when I went to her gravestone, it was funny, I brought the fudge and there was another family there also with Kay's fudge. They were not related to her. So wow. Both of us treated our fudge recipes that were Kay's. Theirs tasted much better than mine. But we had this really sweet moment, this family that was basically teaching their kids about cemeteries. So yeah, there's just something very fun about food and memorial that it's just kind of grown from there.
With this cookbook, you say, this isn't a normal cookbook. It's a community archive of recipes.
Yeah, the community archive part of it was very much my driving force when dealing with communities in grief. So the idea that, like, this is basically a person who's passed away, and there are people who in recent times remember them, still celebrate them, still miss them. And so the community archive portion was just, you know, if this was a person who had a gravestone recipe and I was going to include them in this kind of unusual cookbook, it had to feature the story behind the person. It wasn't just a collection of recipes. It was also tales sort of behind the recipe. And it had to be through the voices of the people who knew them. So the largest part of this process in researching the book was actually just reaching out to families, getting their blessing, hearing their stories. And so rather than me telling people what it was or just handing out a bunch of recipes without context, it was really important to have that like story with each one.
And these people would come to life for you, you know, even beyond the recipes. I wonder if you can talk about that ritual of making family recipes and how, you know, just cooking them bonds us to the loved ones who've passed.
Yeah, it's so, I think like this project has really taught me, I've always, like, I love food. My family loves a good gathering surrounding a table. And I think I didn't fully appreciate how important food traditions and rituals are for connecting with one another. You know, the idea of someone cooking for you is such a gesture of love and time and labor. And all of these families, the reason why in a lot of cases this recipe was picked was because it was something they would make every holiday. They would host all the gatherings. They were this like centerfold of their community and their loved ones. And there was something lost when that person passed away. And people were like, who's going to celebrate our birthday? And like, what are we doing for Christmas this year? Because that person used to host it every year. And so really forming those traditions and taking the time, the recipes don't have to be that fancy. And I think about in my own family, when I'd started the book process, both of my grandmothers had just passed away. And at the funeral of one of them, we were talking about this yellow cake that she would make for all of our birthdays. And we were like, oh my gosh, we're gonna miss her cake. And she made it for like every single birthday for every year. And my mom was like, it's just box cake. Like there's nothing that fancy about it. But it was like, to me, that's still, yellow cake is just my favorite birthday cake. I want it every year. And so, Yeah, it doesn't have to be fancy, but it's just that time spent with others over food. So when I started meeting with the families, in some cases, we actually cooked together just to kind of recreate that experience of like, what would you talk about while the cookies were baking? And like, when would you make these and that sort of thing?
Rosie Grant is with us, author of the new book, To Die For, A Cookbook of Gravestone Recipes. Rosie, let's get into some of these recipes, starting here in Wisconsin with Karen Nelson's spaghetti chicken casserole. Were you able to visit Karen's gravesite? What did you learn here?
Oh my gosh. Yes, I visited her. She was one of my favorite people that, like, the discovery process was so enjoyable. I believe I'd learned about Karen's gravestone from Reddit. Someone had walked past her grave and posted it in a Reddit thread. And so I reached out to the cemetery and I was like, and this is a pretty common in just researching and trying to connect with the families, but I called them and, you know, I had asked for details and they go, the woman who worked there was like, oh, we don't normally, we would never bother the families for something like this. This is personal information. They're like, that being said, this family is so fun. They love this woman so much. They had this huge party when she passed away. They made this casserole. They brought, I think, like cider, and they just gathered around her gravestone. They invited all the people who worked at the cemetery, and they had basically a party at her grave to celebrate her. And they'll even still, like, her granddaughters occasionally will take lunch at her bench. And she is just so loved. And so in any case, they reached out to the family, and like, it was like 30 minutes later, I got a text from the daughter being like, hey, let's chat about my mom. And her daughter, Michelle, just tells so many funny stories about this woman. She loved Christmas. She was like Hallmark times 10 for Christmas. She would make these incredible cakes. And like, yeah, her bench is just incredible. And one thing I thought was kind of cool is the way that her body was placed. In some cases, cemeteries have different like regulations of like where people are facing, but in the case for them, they wanted her facing her bench. So like when you're sitting at the bench, it's like you're having a conversation with her.
Oh, I also loved how her daughter Michelle said that, you know, casseroles were in her DNA, and casseroles and weekly dinners were the currency of the community, of Racine. And I thought that was so lovely. And it really touched to the heart of the impact Karen made on her family and the community.
Yeah, like hearing about their weekly dinners and the fact that the grandkids, Michelle was even saying, she was like, you know, grandma can make other things. And the kids wanted this exact casserole every single week because it was just comfortable and like it was delicious and it was, you know, it just feeds you really well. And when making it, I was like, well, this is great. I have all of my meal prep and leftovers for the week. I can bring this to a dinner party. Like it just feeds a lot of people. And so I love that that tradition got carried forward with them like still making this casserole.
Okay, we're going to go slightly to our neighbor west here, Pine River, Minnesota, with Isabella Carlson's Easy Potato Rolls. What was so special about these rolls for Isabella and her family?
Oh, that was such a special one, too. I visited her, actually, just her, and I was lucky enough to get to meet her daughters. We met at a local diner where another family member was actually the cook at. And Isabella, again, similar, was such a center of her community and showed love through cooking for other people. She was this chef at a local summer camp, and she would make the rolls. She would make other dishes too. And the kids like still remembered her years later. And from my understanding is a bunch of them even like bussed out for her funeral. They were, you know, a few hours south in the city. And when they had heard that she passed away, all these people came out to attend her funeral. And the potato rolls are really good. They're kind of like to me, like, sort of Hawaiian potato rolls, but having them fresh, mm-hmm. like fresh out of the oven, homemade, the way that your like house smells. And when her daughters would talk about, she was like, there's nothing like when they were away for college and when they were homesick, their mom would be making these potato rolls. And then they are like, we can smell that. And just we are immediately back in our mom's kitchen.
Oh, that is really special. We also have to talk about the entry for the radio star, Deb Nelson from Crawford County, Iowa. What is the story behind her Red Lantern cheese dip?
Oh my gosh, what isn't the story with Deb Nelson? Deb was such a lark. Like you said, with all of these people, I wish I'd known them. I wish I'd met Deb Nelson. She is just such a phenomenal person. And like, it still feels so, someone who's just so present in her community. So when I went out there, I feel like I couldn't get like five steps without someone new coming along who had a Deb Nelson story. So yes, she was a local radio DJ and like neighborhood mom. She would host really fun parties. She would have these iconic Halloween costumes every year. And yeah, she, you know, won pickle contests. And when it came to the Red Lantern cheese dip, the recipe that's on her gravestone, basically there was a local sort of steakhouse called the Red Lantern, and her eventual husband, he would go very often, and he would always, she would be like his server, and he would always order this cheese dip. And eventually he asked her out, and then they got married, and they had their wedding reception at the Red Lantern. And then for holidays, she would make a whole big batch of this cheese dip and hand it out to all of their neighbors and friends and family. And you would only get more cheese dip the following year if you brought your jar back. So it was this like really fun tradition. And like her daughter even talks about when people would ask for this recipe, she would say like, essentially, like, you can have it at my funeral, you can have it over my gravestone. Whether she was kidding or not, like, she said it very frequently. And so when she passed away, her family was like, well, I think we know what we have to put under her gravestone. It's the cheese dip recipe.
I love the note from the family that the bacon bits and the recipe should be the ones you buy at the store that may not contain any real bacon. I mean, the shortcut nature of some of these recipes, that they weren't, like, they were unfussy. They weren't snobby about ingredients.
Yeah. Exactly. So like some of the recipes are like pretty short and sweet, or they're like a classic grandmotherly recipe that makes a million cookies. Yeah, none of them are super complicated. And I think both that's a wonderful thing about some of the staple foods that we crave when we're homesick, or we are nostalgic, or we want to feel like we're celebrating our special day, something like that. It's like, sure, we love a fancy steak tartare, but we also love a chocolate chip cookie. And so I love that a lot of these recipes are actually pretty simple.
Rosie, you've been surrounded by the topic of death while writing this book. How did working on this project change your perspective on death?
I think for me, it made me realize that I was like the taboo side of death in Western culture, I was very much living in. Like, I should say my parents are both ghost tour guides, so I wasn't unaware of cemeteries. But at the other side of, I think, the concept of death itself, I found very scary. And I remember being a little kid and being like freaked out about the idea that one day all of my loved ones will pass away. And I think for me, the way I had dealt with that growing up would have been like, well, don't talk about it. Don't talk about it, because then, you know, it won't happen, or something like that, which is not how these things work. And so I think seeing the celebration of life of all of these people makes me much more comfortable talking about these things. I can talk about it with friends now. I feel like just much more open about like, well, how do you want to be remembered? Do you want to be cremated? Do you want to be buried? Do you want a recipe? Do you love music? Do you want your favorite music notes? Do you want this being played at your funeral? And I really love this concept of like, what's the thing that people will see in the future that they'll think about me when they see that? And so, in any case, it's just made me a lot more comfortable thinking about these things.
Rosie, thank you for the conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Rosie Grant. Her new book is called To Die For, A Cookbook of Gravestone Recipes. We've been hearing about gravestone recipes and the stories of the people behind these dishes, these sentimental dishes and rolls and sweet treats. And now it's time for you to share. What recipe would you like to be remembered by?
What do you think is your gravestone recipe? Is there a dish you're known for preparing that everyone in your family thinks of you when they eat it?
Rob, you're in the kitchen a lot. I'm going to put you on the spot for your gravestone recipe.
Well, that's difficult, Kate. My thing is soup, especially this time of year. But the recipe always starts, open fridge. See what needs to get used up in soup. It's fridge soup. You can't really write a recipe for it.
Let's hear from you on gravestone recipes. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or leave us a voicemail. You can text us. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Joe Tarr, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.